item is to look at the annual report of the company's intellectual property commission. You can see that by the fact that these guys are being called in, that really they are very strategic when it comes to the economy of our country. Because whatever goods are going to produce, if they're not of good quality, those goods cannot be sold, they cannot sell outside the country. But we know that even before those goods can be produced, there must be companies who must produce that, the companies who must produce those goods. So this commission is necessary to be here to ensure that the companies and the intellectual property that we're having is registered and then we're able to take our country forward. So all of you are welcomed into this meeting. But what is critical here is we are having apologies. The first apology is that of the chairperson of the committee. She is in Brussels, where she's attending the South African EU summit for the whole week. So she's not looking around. She would have been here. She would have been here, if the circumstances were allowing. But the issue of international engagement, as I say that, but a proper committee of trade and industry. If we cannot trade, it is of no use for this committee to be interact. So that's why she had to go out there to ensure that the presence of trade for the country is being widened out. So our chairperson is there. She sends her regards to you. She knows that you are going to deliver as if she's around. But I know she's around somewhere in spirit. She's around somewhere. And then we also have other standing apologies. That one of Honorable Dr. Oriana Ambrosini, which is a medical condition. I think everyone but will have to reiterate that every so that can be on the record of Parliament. And then also Advocate Albert has also indicated that he will not be available. He's spreading himself thin with court cases. I don't know whether he's going to win them or not, but he's trying like that. So let him go and do it. And then also the apology of Ms. Joyce Cross, the one, the Chief Operating Officer of the DGI. There's an apology for her. He's involved with the interviews of the Deputy Commissioner for the NCC. Those are the apologies. I don't know from the political parties. No. The DA has got a full complement. The ANC has got a full complement. And the OP has got 1.5 complement, more than a complement. So I think that there are no apologies for that on that political. Yeah. So we are all welcome. So we can go straight now to the first item on the agenda, which is the adoption of the agenda. Can someone propose the adoption of the agenda? But before we propose that adoption, no, SADS and CIPC are two different animals. I don't think that we can take the question time together. So what I suggest is that the first hour, we put it for the South African Bureau Standards, and then go through it, we finish it, we engage with them, and then out they go, and then after that we go with the CIPC. Because the way it is structured here, as if we were just going to have one long discussion, we are not going to do it that way. We are going to break this thing into two. Can someone propose the adoption of the agenda? Honorable Will Lewis, propose. Honorable McIntosh, support. All right. Thank you. All right, honorable members, the South African Bureau of Standards is here today, represented by Dr. B. Meromakulu, the CEO of SAPS, and Ms. E. Lefteris, the CFO. You know, we're dealing with money. She's the custodian of the assets there. And the executive, Mr. F. Magamu, dealing with the certification. I don't know if my mom is going to deliver. Yeah. So let's give her a chance to deliver. The maximum time I'm going to give her is 30 minutes. Please do your presentation in 30 minutes so that in the next 30 minutes the committee can engage with that presentation. You're welcome, CFO.
Thank you, Chair, Honourable Chair of the meeting, Honourable Members, good morning. It is always a pleasure for the SABF to get an opportunity to engage the Committee on Trade and Industry on the business of the SABF. They come from one of the oldest institutions in the country. The institution that we believe that South Africans have always been proud of, And as we do our work, we always remember that we are representing the pride of the country and the integrity associated with the products in the country. The chairperson has introduced, I have members of my expo that are accompanying me, and the CFO will come in to deal with the issues of it, but I will give an overview of the presentation as has been submitted to the honourable member. We structured the presentation to look at the issues of the mandate, and to also look at the strategic objectives that we've set for ourselves, and the financial highlights and the audit findings, the tracking mechanism that we have with the Office of the Audit General, and the challenges that we see as an organization, and reviewing the activities of this year with the first quarter performance results. As I've indicated, we were the oldest institutions formally established by the Act of Parliament in 1945, and the Act was amended in 2008 and split the SADF into two entities, and the entity that remained as the SABS was then given mandate to develop, promote and maintain South African national standards, promote quality in connection with commodities, products and services, and vendor conformity assessment services, and assist in matters connected here. And we continue to engage with the mandate as board and enabling as it is. But the amendment of the Act 2008 fundamentally changed some of the engagement that the SABS was having in the economy, and that involved the corporate specifications, which was then moved out of the SABS into a regulatory function, which is called the Regulator of Compulsory Specification, NRCS, which is a standalone, and it was given a mandate to recommend compulsory specifications to the Minister of Trade and Industry, administer, maintain, and reinforce compulsory specification, carry out market surveillance through inspections in order to monitor compliance. It was important that we differentiate the two mandates in the presentation, because often I find when I talk about the SABS, people end up going back to the old mandate and requesting or engaging with the mandate of the entity which is the NRCS in the SABS space. And differentiating the two mandates is always important to do up front, just to make sure that we have an understanding that the SABS in 2008 fundamentally changed in the eyes of the consumers and the eyes of the manufacturing entities. And change management process, I'm going to talk about, because we're starting to get impact of that change management. And I did last year when the committee visited the SABS campus, I did speak about some of the challenges that we're facing because of the change management process associated with the regulatory split. In 2009, when I was asked to take over as the CEO of the organization, we then worked on a process to understand our organization, understand where the organization was following the split, and where we were going as an organization. We worked with our board to come up with a five-year strategy, and the strategy really was looking at ensuring that the SABS in its new form was able to deliver on its mandate. We engaged the mandate, we engaged with the customers, with the employees, with our shareholders, and we came back with a strategy that was trying to address an SABS that delivers the value to the economy and that addresses the challenges that the organization had in delivering on its mandate, technical capabilities and the infrastructure included. The initial stages of the implementation of that strategy involved a lot of understanding the operational challenges that the organization had and fixing those challenges. So as we were implementing the strategy, we also had to ensure that we addressed the challenges that the organization had. And the challenges had to do with the capacity, the level of expertise that the organization had against the expectations that we put on the organization, the ability of the organization to meet the mandate, and the ability of the technical infrastructure that was in the organization to deliver on the expectations. And as we were delivering on the strategy, we were also trying to ensure that we address the challenges that were before us. We also engaged with the issue of relevance to support the policies of our government. IPEP became the central policy framework that was driving the activities of the SADF, and we aligned our activities to ensure that we were supporting the policies that are aligned to economic growth of the country, and ensuring that we design our programs to support IPEP. We have an annual program with the DTI, and it's monitored quarterly through engagement, and we report on those engagements in our quarterly reports as well. After a 2% growth last year, the year under review, we managed to achieve 15% growth on revenue year on year. As the members, honourable members will know, SABS is about 75% commercial, which means we earn our own revenue through the entity, and about 25% of the budget we earn from services that we render to the economy. And the 15% growth was a combined growth in revenue from the grant that we get from DCI and external revenue. We also managed to achieve 9 out of 10 performance indicators from the business plan that we had committed to our shareholders. Our strategic objectives are anchored on what we call the balanced scorecard, which is four perspective of growth, customer centricity, productivity, and competent and empowered employees. With SABS as regulator, the issue of the customer was never at the center of the organization's strategic focus. But with the regulator out of the SABS had to attract the customers, excel in the servicing of the customers, and we had to put the customer at the center of the activities that we do. So most of the activities that we're doing in the five-year strategy have to do with making sure that we create the value so that the customers, which are a different sector of the economy, including the consumers, see the SABS as a service provider of choice. In that way, we think we can then achieve our growth targets that when we address productivity issues within the organization and we have competent and empowered employees, the growth will be a byproduct of all those things that under their perspective of growth coming right. So the focus is to make sure that productivity within the organization is addressed, and that we address the skills and the expertise within the organization, and that we excel and we ensure that our customers are happy with the services that we give them. And when that happens, then the growth is not going to be an issue. That's how we've summarized our strategic objectives. Under the perspective of growth, in the year under review, we were able to meet our targets in terms of the revenue and the number of published home growth standards. We in support of IPEP, produced more standards, home growth standards than was required, and we also produced more conformity certificates, and that was our biggest growth area in the year, the certification business that Mr. Frank Makamo is in charge of, and the number of test reports also was exceeded. But obviously the labs will take time to get to a stage where we say we have the state-of-the-art laboratories. We're working in the Newtland. We'll be working on issues of automation, and we'll be working on issues of ensuring that our equipment keeps up with the industry development. So we have a plan over the next 3 years to upgrade our equipment in the labs to make sure that we have a state-of-the-art infrastructure. So the baseline on the test reports really is talking to the old infrastructure that we have as an organization, and we're monitoring the turnaround times using these test reports on the infrastructure that we have in place. External revenue grew by 21%, and it's mostly driven by our certification, ISO 9000, ISO 14000, and the MAC scheme products that we have as an organization. And we're starting to support our government departments more. We finished in the year under review the setting up of the set-top boxes laboratory, and the lab is being affected, but SABS on the side of the digital migration is ready on the side. On our side, we've invited the minister, the new minister of communications, to come and see the lab with our minister, because we think it's something that the two ministers can be proud of. We have the technicians ready to do the work, and obviously, as you are aware, there are challenges there in terms of some of the companies challenging the standard through court, and the lab is then at the moment standing and still doing tests to ensure that to make sure that we can keep the lab running. But the work that is supposed to bring in revenue is not happening because obviously there's still issues of the standard in court. It's being dealt with in court. We also, and the members have seen, maybe we'll cut lunch, the issues around installation of solar water geysers and the challenges where even when the geysers have been tested by the SABS, the company that procures the solar geysers then give the installation to companies that are not SABS approved. So they use top and tiles that are not SABS approved. And you find, even though the geyser itself is SABS approved, but the installation does not follow a standard that is approved, and people then have problems and challenges. When the geyser leaks or the roof is not tested for the right length to support that geyser, and people's lives are endangered. So ESCOM took initiative to make sure that all the installations, they took a sample and they got SAS to go and verify that the installations were done in accordance with the standards and that the right materials were used in the installation. In the year under review, we were also honored with the appointment by the DTI as the Local Content Notification Office. We've established the office. We've put the right infrastructure in place. We will be obviously starting the activity to set the baseline to make sure that we can show and demonstrate when we come to present at this platform, ensure that there is progress against the policy objective that the Ministry of Trade and Industry has put forward. It is, we think, at SABS, a great opportunity for the country to be able to monitor local content and to be able to have the visibility of which departments, which state entities are procuring locally against the sectors that have been mandated for local content. And SABS is really excited to be the verification body that's going to assist with ensuring that the data that does come through to our government is the data that can be verified. On the issue of customs centricity, as I've indicated, this is a new issue for the SABS. We've been a regulator in the past, and people came to us in order for them to operate. Now they don't need to come to the SABS. They come to the SABS because we're giving them good service. So it's important that we go out and we find out if people are happy with our activities, and whether it's the private sector companies or our government that is serving, we have to make sure that we measure the impact that we're making. We then, under the IPA program, we measure our progress against the commitments that we make to DTI, and we develop standards in accordance with the IPA plan approved, and we achieve the targets there. And of the projects that were introduced for conformity assessments, we had one indicator that we could not achieve. And as I've indicated, when we invest in the infrastructure like the one that spoke about for set-top boxes, you have to have a return on investment. Otherwise, you will have a white elephant. We come here to respond to a white elephant issue. So we go through a process of ensuring that we get a return on investment discussion with the companies that are going to be using the service. In this case, for Euro 6 upgrade, the companies were not willing to give the commitment. So we ended up having to use the historical data and their manufacturing plans and emails that they were sending us in order for us to justify to our board that the investment could be made to upgrade the facility to Euro 6. but also we were helped by this time associated with the procurement, because most of the equipment that we needed was going to be coming from overseas. This lab is the only lab in Africa that is not privately owned. So the equipment that we use for the lab is not in the continent. We had to then wait for the equipment from another country. If it wasn't for that, we would have achieved our target 100% last year. We engaged a brand company to do a survey on how SAB services were, SAB as a brand was seen by the consumers, by the companies, by the stakeholder community, and they came back to us with a report that we shared with our board that indicated a balanced view that said we have a value in the minds of the South Africans that respect the brand, that have a lot of faith in what SAGS could do. But the companies that engage with us wanted to see more innovation in the way we're doing our work, and that was useful feedback that we got. And this all goes to the SABS that really has to stand up and say we're competing with other companies that offer the same conformity assessments, and the companies are not South African companies. These are companies that come from Germany, Switzerland. They're foreign companies, the SGSs, the TUEs, competing with those companies. So we have to excel in giving the South African economy services to make sure that there is credibility in the services in the country. We also did the customer survey. These are people that are directly using ABS services, and we wanted to know if we were performing according to their expectations, and the average was around 8 for the performance against that survey out of 10. Between the results of 6.5 to 8.5, which really show that there is still that excellence in the organization. There are areas that they would like to see improvement, but they feel that respect. We, as part of our customer centricity objective in 5-year strategy, we decided to go and invest in the upgrade of our ICT infrastructure, including the customer relations management portal and web stores. Standards internationally are now bought on the internet, and the SABS had to catch up with those developments. Otherwise, South African companies will buy the standard directly from Switzerland, at a price that does not recognize that the economy is already investing in standards. When we adopt the standards from ISO, the South African economy gets standards at the value that really takes into account that our government invests in the process of standardization. South Africans pay about 40 to 50% less for adopted standards than they would if they bought directly from the ISO website. ISO is an international body that looks at standardization globally. They measure the importance and the effectiveness of standard bodies using their own indicators. One of the indicators is a leadership position that you have in the ISO community. And as ADBS, we measure that because it shows the impact that we're having at that international platform. So technical management, that's where countries decide which issues should be you should be taken up for international standardization. SABS's presence at that level ensures that South African issues can get to the platform. So we always try and ensure that we are in those leadership positions, which is Secretariat of Committees and Technical Management Board. For 2 years, I represented SABS on the ISO Council, which is the board of ISO, and that also ensures that we can bring developing countries and Africa issues on the ISO Council platform. And we manage that, and we make sure that we keep SABS up there with the countries that are engaging at that level. There are permanent members that are always there, the six most developed countries, which include China now, and all the permanent members, the other members are selected every year, and you have a year that you have to take a break and then come back, and we compete for those positions. So we measure them because they show the impact you're having at an international level. SABS hosts, from the start, has always hosted the Hazard STEM Secretariat, and obviously we use the grant funding to make sure that we support the activities to ensure that the Hazard STEM platform works. Productivity, this is a difficult part when you're dealing with an institution that is old. In that you're dealing with technology that is old, but also you're dealing with a mindset that is focused in a certain era of activities, and to move your human capital to a new way of doing things, productivity is an effort that I think when we write strategies and we say we're going to achieve this, you don't really think about the change management process that associated with moving people along. But with the SABS, there was also an infrastructure issue that I've spoken about, not just the equipment in the lab, but the ICT infrastructure. In the standards development activity, today people don't come in a room like this and engage. If they do come in a room like this and engage, they do it once, and then follow-up activities are done electronically. So you need an ICT infrastructure with the right broadband to support electronic committee engagement. And if SABS does not sort out the ICT environment, we cannot engage with a new way of developing standards, but also we cannot engage with a new way of testing. If somebody brings a sample for testing, we need to be able to send a quick email to say we've received your sample, it's going to take so many days. For all of those, you need an ICT infrastructure that can support those applications. Even with the certification, the companies don't want our auditors to come with paper. They want them to come with tablets to be able to keep their information. And when they finish auditing, they want to get a report straight away to say how the audit went. They don't want to wait a week for this person to go with the paperwork and go type the report in the office. So the environment that we're operating in has really required that we change we upgrade our infrastructure. LIMS, the e-committee, as I've indicated, we agreed with what we were going in that direction, and we are piloting these activities already. So the new way of doing things is not something we're thinking about, it's something that we thought of in 2010, we put in our strategy, we started implementing, we're in a position where we're piloting these activities. We're also focusing on accreditation. When somebody does test, we want to know that we can trust the results that come from that lab. I do remember that the committee engaged, was it last year or year before, with the issue of condom testing, and of course our lab is accredited, and we knew that the work that we had done in the lab was the work we could stand behind. We did not see a need for us to be engaging in the media about what was being alleged about the SABS testing, and that's the confidence you get when you accredit your lab. When a person questions your capability to test, you can then show that the third party has said you are able to test the product. Learning and growth, obviously, as I've indicated, the transition for SABS has meant that we have to focus on our expertise base. And when we say we are good, we're talking both about our people and we're talking about the equipment that we have and the culture within the organization. And that's why there is such a focus on learning and growth. We've invested a lot of resources to make sure that we give our people opportunities to upskill themselves. We're working with a number of employees. About 30% of our employees would have MSHIC and been in the same position for some of them 20 years, and you want to give them an opportunity to upskill themselves or even go through a recognition of prior learning and find opportunities to really find new excitement. One of the issues we deal with in the organization is that people see the important role that SABS plays in the economy exposes us to sometimes employees wanting to get in and take an opportunity to sell this credibility. And we have systems and processes in place to make sure that we protect the organization against that. But when people don't see hope for themselves, the temptation is always high to, you know, I'm not going to get a promotion because I'm not qualified. There are no opportunities for me to go up in the organization. And they then use the opportunities to try and make money out of the activities of the FDA. And when people are excited about what they're doing and they know that there are opportunities for them, we don't think that people would want to do that. But it does happen. And from time to time, we face with the situations where we have to then deal with the employees, dismiss people because they've tried to talk to a client about, you know, giving or dealing with the process in a way that the system doesn't allow. And obviously, we always catch those people because the system will show whether it's in the financial stages or their manager will pick up that there's something that doesn't correspond in what the results say and the recommendation. But in that case, a person doesn't think about the systems that I say, they just think maybe I can get away with it. So we look at the staff resources, we have succession planning, we're developing our capacity, we put policies in place to make sure that we can sustain the goals and the improvements in the organization. We enrolled about 20 students in the Da Vinci program. Some of them were doing certificate programs they completed, and two managers are going to be graduating. They're defending their master's thesis with Da Vinci 2 months ago. And in August, we graduated 19 managers that had completed a Harvard Leadership Development Program. So that's the space for managers, but there's a space for technical employees as well, and we have a career development program for them. Financial highlights, I'll ask the CFO to just go through those quickly and touch on the audit issues as well.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Members. As Bonnie has pointed out, we have had a good year in terms of our revenue. We grew 15% year on year on a total revenue base, but the commercial revenue, which is our own generated revenue, grew by 21%. So we ended up on a revenue of 680 odd million for the year. Our expenses did grow a little bit more than the revenue simply because we continue to invest in our people, invest in training and invest in equipment, which means that we were slightly down on net profit of about 9% year on year, but despite that we still earned a profit of 31.1 million. In terms of the audit findings, I just want to address the yellow phases in the current year. And really there were three areas there that we need to hone or pay a little bit more attention on. On the leadership side, what we found is that we didn't have annual declaration from our employees in terms of their business with the state. What we do with key personnel, they had to declare that annually, whereas the rest of the employees were declaring upon entry into the organization. So the finding there that was that we didn't update that annually, and we certainly put that in place now. In terms of financial and performance management, on the record-keeping side, it referred mainly to the asset register. During the financial year last year, we did a complete verification of our assets. So we went and counted each and every single asset. It was a very time-consuming exercise, bearing in mind that we got thousands of assets. So by year-end, we hadn't completed the trailing. So there were still some assets, for example, that weren't barcoded, or some old assets which we're still using that weren't on the asset register. So that related to that funding. Our target is to complete that process now by the end of October so that everything is traced and recorded at the correct value. And then the last issue related to the ICT controls. As part of our strategy, we look at rejuvenating the ICT structures and applications. So in that comes the process, which means by year-end we hadn't completed everything. We had established a proper infrastructure, but for example, change management hadn't been formalized, so there weren't records in terms of putting applications into production, and some of the passwords of Unix system weren't completely controlled. But we're confident that with the strategy, all that is being addressed. We've just put in place a governance structure. We have an ICT steering committee established with external representation, so we're confident that we'll manage those issues.
I want to challenge you, honourable members. I must start off by saying that we enjoy a lot of support from the Department of Trade and Industry. There is never an issue that we bring to the table, either through the DG, the Chief Director that supports us, Dr. Demana, and the acting DDG, that is never addressed. The issue of the Act and the split of the NRCS, we've been working with the department and with them very clear support for us to sort out the situation around the implications or the unintended consequences that are associated with the split of the SADS and the NRCS. One of the issues for us is that as we targeted growth, we really did not see that industry was going to react to the Article 9 repeal that was in the Act, because they now have to pay levies, and so the SABS mark, which was used in the past when SABS was a regulator, has in their eyes lost value. So the open door there is that a company from another country can come with a report from another country and come and get a permission, an LOA, for them to bring the products in the country. And that's a loophole that was not seen in the repeal of the 209. But we're working with the NRCS to make sure that we close that loop and the DTI, and ensuring that we reinforce the importance of the SABS mark to verify to the consumer and the people buying the product that the product is been tested in South Africa, and that they can be confident that they're buying a product that really is not competing unfairly with the products that are in South Africa, that go through a regulatory mechanism in South Africa. Because when you have two regulatory mechanisms, it's unfair for the South African companies to go through the SABS mark process, which is a rigorous process to make sure that the product meets the standards, and there is an easier route on the other side where the company does not have to go through that. So closing that loop with the department and the NRCS. We also have issues of labor instability. You would know that when the split happened, the NRCS was accommodated within the SADS SAR. And from the onset, they had challenges with their employees, and that went on for 2 years, and they were not able to resolve the issues. But you know, out of that instability, in trying to make peace, there was an agreement that was reached with the employees, but the employees of the NRCS then took that agreement and gave it to the SABS employees to say, you can get the same if you take the same strategy. So last year we had our employees benchmarking against the agreement that the NRCS had gotten and going out on the streets to say they demanded the same. Again, we appreciated the intervention from the department and them then setting a way for us to say we have to harmonize and we have to work with our employees to make sure that what government officials at those levels get is not better than, you know, what the employees in the state entities get. So we had to harmonize in that space. So we've agreed on a 3-year wage agreement with the employees, but that's now then putting pressure on our profitability and the costs in the organization. The other question that was put in the briefing was that we must look at the adjustments and the realignments that are required. It's always a difficult one. The previous year we did 2% on revenue, then this year under review we did 15%. We're struggling a little bit this year at this point with our financial performance, but I always say to my FCO that I want to see a stretch. We have to stretch ourselves. We have to aim for growth. We have to aim for bettering the environment with which we work. So the targets are high, and there are arrangements to make sure that we look at continuous improvement. But at a certain point, it then becomes an issue where the department is concerned that it doesn't look like we're meeting those targets. But for me, it's a balance between ensuring that there is credibility in our setting the targets, but also you keep the organization motivated for stretch, for continuous improvement. And that's a balance that we try and strike and continuously engage with the targets as we report quarterly to the shareholders. So the third quarter, and if you can just quickly take us, our time is nearly up.
Okay. As mentioned, the revenue in the third quarter has been below performance. And really what has caused that is there has been a bit of a drop in the Mark Scheme revenue. Some clients have cancelled Mark Scheme, but mainly in the new business side, it hasn't materialized as fast as we would like it to. But statistically, the first quarter normally is quite a low quarter for us. You know, it could be a fatigue from the year end, so it does drop slightly. But we are looking at trying to get that revenue in. You know, on the new revenue side, we do have challenges in terms of turnaround with our partners. Some of the new revenue is taking a bit long because of turnaround times with them. Percentage of laboratories that are profitable, we put a focus onto that to say each and every laboratory must be sustainable. So we put this annual target in to say at least two-thirds of our laboratories must be profitable, and I'm happy to report that at the end of quarter one, we're sitting at an actual of 54%. There's definitely focusing on productivity and costs, although still quite a bit of work to do on there. New training courses, obviously with local content verification, we had the opportunity there to develop a course around that. The number of published homegrown standards were exceeded by giving priority to the running project so that we could complete those. New schemes, we've achieved two. In fact, we've achieved our annual target, local gap and under 50,000. In terms of the number of SMEs whom projects are implemented, quarter one is shown as zero. However, we are in the process there, and again, there's the tardiness in terms of signing MOUs, but we're confident that in this next quarter we'll be able to sign that. The number of advisory forums we've achieved, in terms of the percentage of committees fully installed on e-committees, again, first quarter we didn't achieve, but at the moment we're looking at about 33% of the committees being on the new platform. The percentage of compulsory specifications, we've achieved that target. We've put a lot of focus in terms of where we spend our CAPEX, and the CAPEX was directed to those. Percentage of laboratories that are on lab, quarter one is showing a 0%. We changed the approach in terms of the LIMS implementation by deciding to configure all the laboratories first rather than going on a lab-by-lab basis. Because our laboratories are so different, we thought it would be best to configure all of them so we could pick up all the issues and all the differences. We have piloted in the one laboratory, and 90% of our labs have been configured, which means we're in a user acceptance testing phase, and we're hoping to implement all laboratories by March. Percentage of laboratories on mission-directed work team, we've changed the approach there as well. So as we go along and see what the issues are in the organization, we try to change the approach. So the initial proposal on mission-directed work teams was to look at workflow and goal setting, etc. What we've decided to do now is rather to focus it on equipment efficiency to extract that value out of the labs. On the people side, we wanted to develop business development capacity and technical thought leadership. Once again, we reviewed the landscape and decided that we didn't have to go outside to employ those skills. So what we've done is we've assigned specific members in the organization with that skill. So four employees within the organization have been assigned to new business development roles and two employees to the thought leadership positions. On the financial side, as we mentioned, we're behind in terms of budget for revenue. However, we have grown between 8 and 9% on last year, so we're confident that we're showing growth on last year. The admin and operating expenses are below budget, simply because some of the revenue hasn't come through, so some contract services haven't taken place, but we've also put a lot of focus on employee costs. and basically put an instruction in that no administrative heads should be employed. So all employment should look at revenue generating capability. And obviously the drop in revenue filters through into the loss for a period of 1.2 million.
Thank you, Alice. And obviously with the focus on managing costs, we are not employing in administrative positions. And so the vacancies that were associated with admin positions have been cancelled. And we only employing what we call engagers, the technical expertise that we need in order for us to meet the mandate. Thank you.
All right, thank you, CEO and your team, for the presentation you've given us. And then I thought that it was supposed to have taken only 30 minutes. It took the whole hour, which was allocated for the engagement. Ooh. But you know, when something is so interesting, you cannot deny the members the chance to hear everything. That's why I think that you can reflect the bullet at the end. Honourable members, this is your presentation. Can I start noting the hands? Honourable James, Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Tring, Honourable Mabasa, and Honourable Mabasa, and Silao, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chair, and I'd like to thank you for the presentation. You projected enormous competence, and you backed it up with a very interesting narrative and very good documents, so thank you very much for that. I had a question in two parts about your polymerase chain reaction labs, your PCR labs, and wanted to ask where things are, because you used to partly outsource them to university labs, but you were also building your own, and I just wanted to know what the status of that is, firstly, and secondly, how well they've been used. I'm particularly interested in whether you're testing for foreign proteins in foodstuff, given the horse meat and donkey meat problems that you had in the past. And secondly, whether you're doing any testing on brining in chicken, frozen chicken, and whether they're coming from the request, because you are essentially demand-driven, right? So so one would imagine that the Consumer Protection Commission would refer those particular things to you for your biochemical labs. Thank you.
Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My apologies for being 3 or 4 minutes late. It's always exciting to hear the SABS's presentation, and Dr. Mitchell Makulu is bringing us, I think, forward, and we're obviously seeing great progress. I have two questions, the one is on page 9, talk of the international committees, and we're sitting on 21 committees where we're either the secretary or the chair. Could you perhaps just quickly tell us what some of those are? Because that's quite a lot. And also, how you cope. Do you have an international affairs department in SABS? Obviously, in ISO you do, and you serve on that. The second question I've got is on page 12, although Dr. Mekka Makula was too polite, she obviously was saying there's corruption and bribery or apparently going on. Now, what I'd like to know is, could she give us an example? I mean, is it, could she perhaps give us some, what the standards are, where there's this bribery and corruption happening? And then, just two quick statements. One is, growing staff is, I think, so commendable. And also, on page 24, the way you decided to use your thought leadership. Now, you may not know, but for the last 60 years, South African Railways and Harbours and now Transnet never did anything except develop their staff from within the organisation. And I think that's very encouraging. I see you do have a technical thought leadership school. Maybe some of the, our MPs, including myself, could benefit from that. And then the other question which I have a concern about, Mr. Chairman, I think it's a matter with this committee, not necessarily now, but we need to address, is this question on page 18 of labour stability. And clearly this is affecting our country very seriously, and it's also affecting this committee in particular, because we are responsible for trade and industry. We just had this very, very bad news from BMW, and we've also seen what INF's had to say. And I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, that we shouldn't request, I don't know if Mr. Irvin Jim is the right person to come and explain himself at this committee, or whether we must get somebody else from, shall we say, the Passatu Kremlin to come and give us some input. But I don't believe trade and industry committee, a parliamentary committee, can just ignore what is happening to our manufacturing areas. Thank you.
We don't need Ivan Jim, therefore. We start from Tuavasa, Waile, Mabasa, and Silao. They are all partners on the ground.
Chairman as well.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Honourable Singh.
Thank you, Chair. Two very simple questions. The first one is with regards to the installation of the water, solar water heaters. I'm wanting to know whether we have been able to curtail the importing of so-called cheap solar water geysers that have come from China, and what kind of intervention has SABS had in that arena. In the area, for example, that I come from, Marine Ridge, there was a proliferation of cheap geysers, and geysers bursting, damaging people's roofs, and so on and so on. And until there was some intervention, and I think as you correctly said, to a large extent, it's poor workmanship. But just the relationship between geysers that have solar water geysers that have come from outside the country, and I'm glad to hear also that we have been actually developing our own, and those are the ones that are going to be installed. The second question is the concern that Honourable McIntosh had as well. With the standardization of salaries, so to speak, members from NRCS who came and said, you know, this is what we did, you can do this. Do you think that it had the unintended consequence of the cost-cutting measures which would then preserve jobs, but then has the consequence of crowding out the unemployed?
Thank you. Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, great Chair. Thanks for an encouraging presentation. My first question is whether SABS has a strategy of selling itself to schools at low levels. You know, when I say at low levels, I'm referring to high schools, so that learners take an interest towards the SABS at that level, so that, you know, they don't only start taking an interest where they are at tertiary or university level. Then my second point is to congratulate you on the report that you got from the Auditor General. That's worth congratulating. And at the same time, to appreciate the fact that you are remarkably able to raise own revenue. Congratulations for that. But at the same step, while this is a good point, is there no danger that the unintended consequences could be where the SMMEs, some SMMEs, I don't want to say all of them, because most of them should be, I mean the big ones, should be able to pay for services, but those that are coming up, is there no danger that they can find themselves excluded from the benefits of SABS because of fear to be charged? Because, you see, once that happens, it also links up to the point where solar water heaters and geysers, actually solar water geysers, are fitted and they are not up to standard, where the fitting equipment and the labor that has been utilized undermines the good work that SABS has done. What is the strategy of making sure that that does not happen? And if it is happening, you know, how does it get addressed for the medium term and the long term? And also, do you have a way, a reach out program, where SABS goes to the SMMEs, to cooperatives, and sell its value so that they see the value of SABS, so that it's not really seen as a step that must be, that organizations have to go through to pass. But they must also say, if I work with SABS, it means the value of my product is higher than if I was not working with SABS in the eyes of the people that buy my product. Thanks, Chair.
On record, please. Try the best for us. Something is not working.
Okay. Who's on this one? Oh, okay. I was looking for something right there. Okay. No, it sounds like working. Just that the rural boy doesn't quickly get to know these things. On slide 9, the last paragraph with a star. You know, this issue of gas emissions is a very important issue because it relates to also our ability to reduce to address issues relating to climate change. I just wanted to know, at this point in time, what is your new target now towards achieving that? And that relates also to your further engagements with the automotive industry. If you could update us on that so that we can see whether there is possibility of that being achieved, probably within this financial year. On slide 12, in fact, it's not only slide 12, it's for a general question. One observes that most of your targets, in fact, almost all of them have been achieved. In fact, you have even done more than the targets that you had set for yourselves. Now, given that you are achieving all your targets, are you planning some upward adjustments to the targets that you have now? And what would then that mean in terms of capacity to as you up your targets in terms of HR and financial capacity as well? I raise this question in, also linked to the number of posts that you have, the total number of posts that you have. I didn't see the actual figure of the posts that you have compared to the posts that are filled and the number of vacancies that you must still fill, and your target towards filling those posts. If you could answer that question in that comprehensive sense. On just a matter of interest, on slide 14, I see three red arrows going up. One, the first one was green, and the following are red, and red does sometimes read the negative. Why is that so? And even the negative 9% profit, although it still is a profit, it's shown as going up instead of going down. Just have a matter of interpretation and clarity there. just one last comment. You know, the issue of employee benefits. I think that's an issue that is understandable, although it does put a strain on your projected profits. But I think it's a matter that is understandable. Perhaps the issue would be the extent to which you are able to regularize your employer benefits between yourselves and the rest of the other sister entities, so that it does not read like it's a chase mesh. And I don't think that we want to say to the employees they don't deserve it. I do not think that we want to say to the employees, if you demand these salaries equal to those that your counterpart are getting, you are closing the door for others to get employment. I don't think that should be the attitude. But lastly, Chair, I want to commend the SAPS as well on the manner in which they focus on building capacity for your human resources. It's really commendable, and I think that we should say well done and continue to do so. However, one would want to understand what is your, given that you have such a high level of allowing your workers to upgrade themselves. What is your retention strategy so that you don't lose, you don't train people, skill them, and then lose them to other people, to other entities, or even to the private sector?
Right, Honorable Gavaza, I'd like you to go a long way because, no, this entity comes once in a blue moon in this parliament. But I'll appeal to the next speakers, please let us be economical with our ways so that we can have give the entity a chance to respond in the department. Honorable Salau.
Well, I'm the unfortunate one, Chair. Okay, thanks, Chairperson. This is not a light load, so don't worry. Chairperson, I first want to take this opportunity to agree with Honorable Comrade Mabas, but to change a little bit on what he was saying, to say SABS is a very, very important tool of standardization and specifications in the nation. But too many people do not know SABS and its role. They know the name SABS there. They see in certain things it's SABS approved. But that's as little as that, and it ends there. I think it is important to engage onto a campaign of advocating and educating society around the importance of this particular quality standard. Therefore, for example, I want to ask SABS to educate us on the relationship between ISO determination of standards, SABS determination of standards, and local content determination of standards. Who does what where? Because the impression one gets from the presentation created of me is that ISO is doing world standards. And whatever you want to do in whichever country, all you have to do is just to make little adjustments guided by the bigger picture. So it's more of a cut and paste with little adjustments to suit your own country and your own areas. And then how can you, with the international standards, be able to do your own local content, which is Susi or local outside of that world? Can you be able to go that far, or do you have to end it? That is the first one. And the last one, President, is the one that relates to issue of the skills development versus the role of SABS in society. That couldn't we perhaps begin to look at this issue of skills skills development as a compulsory matter in all companies in the country? Not only companies, even state-owned companies, as well as the state machinery itself. It should become something that is compulsory. We've been talking too much about it. And who must play that role? Can SABS be able to afford certain standards along the lines of not only education, but skill development? That's
Honorable Waile.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chatterson, and thanks to the team for the wonderful presentation. I just want to start with the first question, which is a topical question posed by in page 18. That is with labor instability and the 3-year wage agreement. My simple question is that at times across all industries you would find that after signing agreements, all social partners take what is, I can refer to as a political holiday till the next round of negotiation. It happens across all sectors. But I just want to check to what an extent is your institution engaging both the employees and social partners on the long-term vision of the institution, including the developments that are taking place in the global economy? Because some of those dynamics impact how you rearrange work and everything. I think to me that's important. To what an extent are we ensure that there's an all-inclusive process in terms of dealing with issues of substantive nature, because that time there's no time for bargaining. Because the problem that when you go to the era of bargaining, people have got their fixated position. But lastly, I want to sponsor the Comrade Chairperson that maybe as a committee we need to have a separate session in terms of what is taking place in the country, what may be the threats in terms of number of strikes, and how can we play our role as government in terms of that particular space. Fortunately, the period in between now, the next 3 years, we're not going to have the collective bargaining. So, Honorable McIntosh, I think that's a kind of proposal that I want to sponsor. The page 8 bullet point, it is with the rollout of the Eskom solar water heater. I think I just want to check what has been the recourse, because you go all over, that has been what is called a quick money-making scheme. The intentions were good, but some other people who were in that space were rolling out. To them, it was a money-making scheme. But now we've got far-reaching implications. We can go to Port Elizabeth. The roofs are leaking in numbers. And now people are not protesting against ECHO and those people who were installing those geysers. They are revolting against the local state. What then constitutes a recourse now? Because if it cannot be managed now and in the near future, it's going to create a pandemonium of which the local state could not be able to contend with that issue. I thought you were going to reflect on the risk analysis and profile. Any institution may have a perfect institution, but there are always the risk. What is it that you can categorize as the risk profile of the institution? and what are the risk management strategies that are in place? Because it's always important to strike that particular balance. I think the last issue is our participation in the ISO Council, where it is said that development countries, the developed countries, have got permanent seat. Maybe the same thing which the President was arguing against in the United Nations Assembly. To what extent is that giving the competitive edge of other countries? Because you're not dealing with standard in a neutral political and ideological environment. Thanks very much.
Right, honourable members, Ray, your questions are highly appreciated. And then, but what must also be appreciated is the report itself. I think it's one of the most comprehensive reports I've seen in this parliament. You know, it's so thick, so full of detail. I think it's good that we have such reports. But what I'm interested in, on my side, is the issue of the standardization of the traditional medicine. That one, it sort of surprised me. I say now the science meets the metaphysical. Because we are already dealing with traditional medicine. It is also a spiritual aspect which is involved. So I was wondering now. The metaphysical is meeting the physical. And I know that the President opened the laboratory which is dealing with that. Can you expand further around that issue? And then number two, on the issue of the regional integration, the issue of, you know, one problem we're having as the African continent is that the trade between the African countries falls around 10% in between them. But the trade within the African countries and their colonial masters is around 70%. So the issue of improving the inter-Africa trade, I think the issue of standards is going to play a critical role. How to interact with the continent, in particular on the EU side, on the issue of trade. And then the other one will be the issue of the support of industrial policy action plan. I think it's very important. I'm very happy that GAS is here today and the chief from the DTI. Because these entities tend to interface with each other. So, you know, this issue of solar heaters, where was SADS when this chief impulse was coming in without putting the standards before? Really, because I think that the government was very clear that we are going green. Why did it have to wait until their horses bolted out of the crowd? And then, I think that I'll take it here up to there. But the issue of labor instability, I think labor rights are human rights. I think that one is fundamental in the constitution of the country. And then some of those things, I think that they are political. I think that must be resolved by the politicians themselves. They must have their own quota and deal with these issues of the economy. Because before that, I don't think that you'll be able to deal with that. Let us be fair to it. All right. So what I'll do, on the issue of the solar heaters, I'll also give GAS a chance to respond because it deals with the industrial policy action plan. I think that it was in his, under his watch that this thing happened. You know? I think I'll give him a chance to respond to some of this, but to keep our own.
Thank you, honourable members. My team will come in to deal with certain issues. Frank is very passionate and has been doing a lot of work around the issues of SMEs, and he's going to talk to the work that we've been doing with provinces around that, and I will address the other issues. And maybe let me just start with the key theme that talks to solar users and where is the SABS when certain products of low quality come through. When I was here last year, I asked the honourable members if their water was SABS approved. And I'm going to use this as an example. There is a standard that talks to the quality of the water. And there is a process that SABS uses to ascertain the conformity of this water to that standard. Now, if our government, through every avenue that they have, procures products and does not use the standards to procure and does not ascertain conformance to the standard when they procure, SABS cannot come in to enforce it unless if it's a compulsory specification, where the NRCS will then come and say you're not meeting a compulsory, it's a regulated product. If it's not a regulated product like the water, but it exposes people to safety, health, and the environment, to the environmental concerns, each and every one of us have a responsibility to say we want a product that conforms to standards. And when we don't, and we have the power to, we don't use the power, we then open our country to all sorts of products coming through. So what happens with solar geysers? The solar geysers are not a compulsory spec. There's a component within that are compulsory spec, that the system itself, there is a standard, and we test against the standard. So what Eskom does is one of the companies that has decided that they're going to follow the standard to the T. They say to the people that come to tender, we will not, you can't tender, you can't submit your tender document without a document that says SABS has tested. Other municipalities don't do that. They don't put that requirement and they don't adhere to that requirement. And what we need is for the country to talk with one voice and say where government is procuring, we want to make sure that the product conforms to the standard. Because if we don't do that at this level, then you will always have problems of service delivery, because the municipalities and the departments and the entities will procure products, and the product is supposed to have a lifespan of 5 years. I usually use road signs. A road sign, the reflective sheeting, is supposed to have a lifespan of 5 years. If we procure those products from another country that's going to produce low quality, and it's not a compulsory spec, so they can bring it in, it's not tested, it lasts only 1 year. You're eating into your budget, because after a year, you have to replace it, because no one will see. You put people's lives in danger, because if it's an error that shows that there's a tight care, you want to miss that, because the reflection material is eroded after a year. So it's those very basic procurement principles that we've let go of that we need to go back to. In other developing countries like India, like Brazil, no product is supposed to come from another country and not go through a standardization organization like the LABS. In our country, we let that open. And that's where we need to tighten. Areas of danger where we don't really just go for regulation, but we use the standardization mechanisms to make sure that what government procures conforms to the standard. We will have less service delivery process, because the work is done, the work on the roads is done, but when the material that is used to tar the road is not good quality and nobody checks, after 3 months that road goes back to, you know, what it was, and the people are saying, why you say you're doing work but you're not doing work, the houses crack and they have to be replaced after they've been built, our government delivers. But when the quality of the materials that we put in the service delivery machinery is not right, we undermining our efforts to deliver. And that is a critical issue that I wanted to put in. And bringing that with Professor Dean's question around our GMO laboratory, that's another issue for me that I do think that we as a country, we miss each other. We have policy objectives. Food safety, all of those issues are important, but there are no legislation or regulations that support it. So we're concerned about these issues, but SABS cannot force people to test. Our mandate does not allow to force it. So we put this laboratory in place, we hired a technician, and we've been engaged on this issue, but we haven't tested one product. Some of the things we go and get in the market to make sure that the laboratory works. But not a single client has come through the door to say, I want to take. Because it's open. You can sell and claim GMO and claim GMO fee, and if there isn't a mechanism to require that testing to happen. So what happens is that we then put the infrastructure in place, because we can see where the policy is going. And when the infrastructure is not used, I and this team have to then sit and answer, why did we invest when the market was not ready for testing? But the market is ready in this area. Food safety and the issues of genetically modified we saw even now with the issue of the DNA traces and the meat, that's the infrastructure we need to have in the country. But the investment will need to be informed by the usage. And if we are not assured of the usage, it will be irresponsible for us to spend the money to put the infrastructure in place and find that there's no usage. Fortunately for this one, it was a small machine, and obviously it's not a focus, and we're using it for other, we're connecting it to other developments to make sure that we give credence to the other tests that we're doing, supplement tests for that we're doing for the medicine council that does the approval. We haven't even done the work on the ground. Again, it's new issues that are coming up. In order for us to put a case to put the testing equipment, we need to have assurance of the usage going forward. The issue of ASO, it came from a number of members, and I need to address it. ISO is an organization of members. So countries, and South Africa was one of the founding members. In 1967, when ISO was established, South Africa and few other countries that were developed came together and decided that we needed an international body that was going to harmonize the standards. So it's an organization of members. There is a small structure that serves as a secretariat. So the standards that are developed internationally, they come from countries. We lead in certain spaces as a country. Mining technologies, prepaid metering, those are our leadership positions. We started those innovations around that area. So we develop a local standard, but we want our companies to be able to sell to Germany and to other developed countries and developing countries. So we propose our standard as a work item for ISO. It goes through a review, and the technical board then decides which items are topical globally, and then they select the items. And the technical committee, they vote that the items that come from South Africa, this item on pre-metering is going to go to a global platform. So a South African standard then gets debated at a global international level, and when adopted, becomes an international standard. The other way it also happens. Another country develops a standard, it goes to the ISO platform. We also do our evaluation here to see that we also need our own standard here. We then adopt the standard, and we have a committee of consumers, industry players that are playing in that manufacturing space, and industry players that are using that product as input into their manufacturing activities. They all sit together to debate the relevance of that international standard to the South African environment. Let me give an example. You see the poles that are used, I'm not sure if they're used anymore by Telkom, but Eskom still use them, the cross-arm poles. They are painted with what we call creosote, to protect the poles not to decay, and when it's planted on the soil. The standard for Britain says that flash point, the point at which the material will ignite, is at 65 degrees Celsius. In South Africa, because of the different climate from Britain, it's higher. So it's the technical people that are in South Africa from industry that are going to debate what standards should be South Africa between the temperature in the country, the uniqueness of our economy, and together they need to agree. Then we go through ISO processes locally to make sure that everybody has had a chance to contribute to the standard. We don't block other people that are supposed to participate in the process. So if I decide that my water is better, so I'll put the standard at this level, so that it excludes other people, I can't do that as a manufacturer. So it's a number of manufacturers in the country that sit around the table, and they come to a point that it accommodates all of them but ensures that we don't drop the standard and put consumers in jeopardy. And it happens from time to time that somebody comes with a new product and industry says, this is competition, we can't allow this person to bring this new product. And that's when we then intervene. We get outside bodies to look at the technical integrity of the new product and for them to advise. And the Act gives us the right to overrule what the industry says on the basis of technical evidence. But when there isn't enough technical evidence and you overrule industry and consumers on a standard and something bad happens, they will say we advise SABF not to and they went this way. So it's a process that is very well managed, international protocols, but also we have our own local protocols to make sure that people are not blocked from engaging with the with the economy. As I said, there is a scoring and the ranking mechanism that ISO uses, and that gives you as a country certain rights and certain privileges, and that is associated with your leadership position. So the people that participate for South Africa are industry players. With the grant that we get from DTI, we then subsidize their travel or assist to these meetings. They help to ensure that South African issues are not left outside the discussion that, say, the international body has a standard that they're developing around an issue of metering. And we know in South Africa we're big on that, but the German companies are wanting to come in and take that market. They could be leading in terms of chairing the committee. A secretariat will come from another country, but if South Africa doesn't participate, they could come up with an international standard that locks out the South African technology altogether. So strategically, we look at our areas of strength and we decide that this industry we're going to lead in that area, we want to be in a leadership position because we want to influence the direction of the technology and the certification in those areas. It's a process of continuous engagement with our industry to determine the level of participation and the leadership position we want to play with each and every standard. The silent issue on corruption, and Frank has had a longer history with SABF than I have, but we've seen a few examples. Christmas, it was 2011, where one of our test officers was caught by the hawks. With our collaboration and with the collaboration of clients, and what happened in that instance is that the customer was testing vehicles that had been converted, and when they tested vehicle, they then needed the LABS test officer to take the vehicle through the test, and the test officer then recommends to the manager, who then looks at all the evidence and it goes through the processes of approval before it's signed off. And that time, the manager was on leave, and the test officer then engaged with the acting manager to make sure that they were signed off. And it went through the processes, and the test officer was engaging client to say to the client, it did not meet, it did not pass, but work with me to make a plan. And that's what we engage with most of the time. So we put layers and layers of approval to make sure that a person will have to be in collusion with five other people in order for them to be able to issue a test report that allows them to do that. It's administratively heavy in the organization, but it gives credibility to the organization, and that's more important than a quicker turnaround time. Because when SABF loses integrity, everything that I've spoken about will not make sense. Because when I've convinced somebody that when we've tested the water, we've tested it, and put the stem, we want the people to believe and to know that they can believe what, you know, that's done. But our system then, working with the client, we're able to detect that, and we involved the hawk, and the guy was caught and dismissed, obviously, from the SADS, and a number of other smaller activities like that. We deal with, I'll say, average 3 a year of attempted cases. And what then gets reflected on the annual report is sometimes where we get financial losses because the person has been able to take the money, their account, and some of those are historical before we upgraded our IT system. Now that the IT system is upgraded, some of those activities will not be possible. I've spoken to the solar water geysers, and the issue of employees and the settlement. But I think the intervention from the ministry helped us as the sister entities to understand that the government department's benefits were structured this way. And the minister had the desire to then help the other entities to get to the level where there is harmony amongst these entities at that level. And that's how we approach our three-year agreement. It's not just to comply with this demand, but it is that we hear and government employees at this level and at this level with these benefits, that's a task with our employees to get to that level. And the issue of how do you fund a trajectory that deals with historical challenges. And then we worked with our board and the shareholders about how we were going to fund it. And part of it has to do with some of our reserves that we're going to use to make sure that we get on par with government employees' benefits. 75% medical aid benefit, by year three we'll get to that level and the employees were comfortable with it. But the important thing is that internally we're working on our own culture, we're working on employee development. I think after 3 years, if we don't put an effort to make sure that we develop the employees, we will find ourselves in the same situation on a different issue. So there are, we have the task team, the HR department, our executive engages in task team on the issues that come up in between the negotiations. So the task team engagement makes sure that we don't now have a holiday. We engage on the issues continuously with our union because we don't want another outburst in 3 years' time. So we're very much aware of that and working on it. Schools program, we're not doing very well in that space, but we have a social corporate responsibility program where we have Saturday school kids coming into the SABS, but also we fund, and Frank was with the Minister of Education on Heritage Day in the Eastern Cape, where we were giving a laboratory equipment to the school, and obviously the school then has a relationship with the SABS, and we ensure that we help them with the material and they have an understanding of our environment. And impact is low, though, because it's driven by our SSI. We can definitely do more. Gas emissions, again, it's an issue of regulation. This laboratory does not make profit, and the reason is that we know there is a need, but the regulation instruments are not forcing the companies to test. In South Africa, we go with what's written in the car based on the tests that were done in a German laboratory, and they put something that says your CO emissions, and that's a theoretical figure. We don't subject those cars or take a sample and subject them to testing locally to make sure that the number that they put there can be verified. Now, we can't force the companies to do it. It has to be a regulated activity. We must, if we're serious about climate change, we have to, as a country, demand that these companies test. If that is not in place, they will then take a theoretical figure that they get from Germany or wherever their parent plant is and come and say, this is, you know, for this engine, this is the emission level. Retention strategy, we've last year our board approved succession planning mechanisms, and for every level we have succession plans, and we're revising our incentive schemes given the growth strategy. I must say the growth at SABS for me personally has to do with an organization that is able to excite if people with a brighter future. They must see progress, but also we should be able to fund our programs. We have opportunities as an organization, and if those opportunities are given to us by our government, like our appointment, local content verification, what we make out of it, we can then cover the wage settlement that we achieve, but we can also bring new people. And as we grow and we put ourselves there and we say to the DTI we can do more, and those opportunities result in us getting revenue and achieving growth, we should be able to then bring more people to the workplace. But also SABS, you will see that we lose a lot of technical expertise. It's because we're seen as a training ground for the country, for quality experts. You will never go to industry and find a head of quality that has never been through the SABS. I visit the plant sometimes to go look at the audit that has been done, the head person there with an SABS person. And we take that responsibility with pride. We say we have to have enough to train for the country because there isn't a space in this economy where people will get practical training on the full value chain of standardization, development of standards, testing, certification and training on standards. That can only happen at the SABS. And that mandate we take with pride. So we train people and the industry comes and poaches it from us and we lose good people most of the time. But we have to keep training the people because then that's some of the economy. But we try and retain them by making sure that we pay at the same level. We will be engaging with the Department of Labor.
Of, because we have other people, let's have about, by 12 we have to pick up.
Sure, okay. Maybe let me give Frank an opportunity to talk about this, traditional medicine work and the SMEs. Yeah, those are the major issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, CEO. I will be very brief on the issue of SMME. As the CEO has said, it's one of the areas that I've got passion on. Honourable Member, I think the question came from Honourable Member Mabasa. Let me acknowledge that indeed it was a concern at some stage about 18 months ago that we were perceived as an obstacle towards SMMEs getting services from the SABS. What we then did as an organization was to engage with our sister company, SEDA, to try and find mechanism of working together to avoid, you know, duplicate efforts, because we thought if we work together, we might be able to achieve a little bit more. We have since established a department at the SABS called the SMME Department, purely focusing on assisting and helping SMMEs. The rate at which we charge to the SMMEs is different from what we would charge normal, well-established companies. We've also realized that SMMEs don't only require, you know, testing of products, but they also require assistance and guidance in terms of the understanding and the interpretation of the standards. That department purely focuses on that. What we've seen since we've established a department about 18 months ago was a positive response to both the public sector and the private sector. To date, we have partnered with the Department of Economic Development in the Eastern Cape, where we've worked together to establish and develop about 16 cooperatives. Just about 5 weeks ago, we partnered with the Mpumalanga province, where we were given about 32 SMMEs to assist them in terms of development and making sure that at the end of the day, we would like to see all of the 32 SMMEs producing products that are SABS approved and meeting standards. And again, because of the partnership that we're having with government, it then results to the SMMEs paying very quickly towards getting the services of the SABS. The very same partnership has been extended to the province of Northwest, where we were given about 16 brick manufacturers, which we are busy developing. It's a very well-going project, and I'm sure within the next 6 months, we will probably have about 7 of those brick manufacturing producing bricks that will be approved by the SABS. The agreement is that should that happen, then we expect that the various departments within the province should then begin to procure from those SMMEs. And again, through the partnership that we have, it also then results to the SMMEs paying very little towards the services that we offer. On the issue of traditional medicine, we have done a lot of work now since the visit by the President to the SABS. We have set up a department that is purely focusing on what we can do. Just recently, I think about 4 months ago, we had an international workshop in Durban where we invited countries that have gone a little bit far in terms of standards in traditional medicine, countries like China, India, where we sit around the table trying to learn on what is it that they did to get to where they are, because instead of us reinventing the wheel, we saw it fit that we should rather learn from the countries that have moved a little bit faster in terms of developing standards in traditional medicine. Thank you, Chair.
I'll give Garth an opportunity.
Chair, thanks very much. The complexity of these issues might be well captured in this bottle, which says method of digestion used in accordance with the SAVS method. So it's not SAVS tested. I personally have been working at the DTI for over 3.5 years. I don't know what this means. I don't know whether this is what produced and bottled in South Africa. And by the way, we import water into bottled water into South Africa. Neither is therefore the country of origin stated or
the company that's manufacturing it. And so I'm just using that to illustrate the complexity of the problem, which the honourable members have correctly identified as solar water heaters. And, you know, we could give a briefing for 3 hours, but let me give it for 3 minutes as follows. The first thing is that there are substandard solar water heaters imported, and the first problem is that those are illegal imports, and therefore customs has to be involved, which is why we work very closely with customs, as we've reported before, in detail on illegal imports. The second instrument that exists is compulsory specifications, and my learned colleague, Dr. Damani, informs me that some, but not all of the components for solar water heaters are the subject of compulsory specifications and therefore fall under the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, which then requires that NRCS works closely with customs to ensure that illegal imports don't happen and substandard imports don't happen which don't meet compulsory specifications. So those are two complications. The third one is that the government has designated solar water heaters for public procurement, and SAS plays, as has been well explained by Dr. Mehlo Makulu, the role of standards as well as local verification. So that's the third complication. I think what this demonstrates, Chairperson, is that the Industrial Policy Action Plan mantra, if you like, which is to lock out substandard products which give an unfair advantage to companies in other jurisdictions to import substandard products into South Africa, which are therefore cheaper and give an unfair competitive advantage and are a danger to safety and security, and at the same time lock in high-quality South African products for the domestic markets and for exports, involves a complex interlocking set of policies and institutions, and we are learning by doing, and I think today's presentation by the leadership of SAS shows that significant progress has been made, at the same time as saying that we've actually got a long way to go going forward, and there is slippage all over the place. I mean, we've just, for example, drawn up a list of municipalities which are in breach of the designations of key issues, and we've written them letters to say you are in breach of the law, and some of them replied that they didn't even know what the law was in relation to the designations, as if that is an excuse, which it isn't. But Chair, I do think that there is significant progress. There's been slippage, there's been import of substandard solar water heaters, it's correct. Lastly, Chairperson, in the interest of time, members might be interested to know that we're working very closely with solar water heater manufacturers in South Africa, some of whom are at the global frontier of innovation and technology. One, for example, recently patented an invention which doesn't require the actual geyser to be replaced, but would require the element to be replaced and simply for solar voltaic cells to be installed on the roof as opposed to the antifreeze device, which is linked up directly to the solar water heater. So I think it's an example of the deployment of public policy measures to ensure localization at the same time as trying to marshal complex regulatory institutions in order to support local manufacture as well as support for innovation and technology. And this solar water heater space, I think, is a very important case study, Chairperson, which at some point you might want to consider getting a more detailed presentation on than we are able to do now. Thank you.
But Honourable members, I think that some of the questions were not answered. So they are not answered. So what I'll rule about is the rural meet that all those questions which were not answered, can you please, but let's say by Friday, this Friday, they must come, the responses must come to the secretary of the committee. So that when we take make a report, a PRR report, we should have got those responses. It's not but the issue of time. We have another presentation to go through, which is also important. So, honourable members, we've got to arrive about 12 o'clock. So there's tea outside there. I request the members to quickly go out and then come back in 10 minutes so that we can start with the second presentation. SABS, thanks a lot for the input and the patience with which you responded to all the questions which were put forward. We wish you well as the portfolio committee of trading industry. We know that it's difficult out there. There's competition. The economy is not as performing as supposed to be performing, but what's critical is that we appreciate the weather doing. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. We are entering the second phase now. Yeah, we are entering the second phase of the presentation. We are having the Intellectual Property and Companies Commission, which is going to present. We are today visited by the Commissioner herself, Ms. Loden, and then the Deputy Commissioner. He was part of the furniture. and Ms. Ndeche, the strategist and planning specialist. So they're here to present the annual report of the Companies Commission. But I think that it is very good. No, it's a good entry. I think the reports which we are getting are not making our head great. At least there's hope for the future of this country. So without a waste of time, I'll request the commissioner fire on with the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. And I think on all our behalf, it's a great pleasure to be here and to be able to address
you and the honourable committee members. We have quite a long presentation, but I'm going to just focus on a few of the slides, so we still have some time for questions. So if you will just forgive us for skipping over some of the slides. I think as the committee is very aware, our institution was formally came into being in May 2011, and we'd outlined from the beginning a plan and indicated that there would be phases for us to implement this plan. So the first year, 2011 and 2012, our focus was on bedding the legislative change, the changes both internally in the organization as well as externally, and on stabilizing the organization. Then in a previous financial year, that is the one that we're reporting on, our focus was on improving service delivery. We had we still have an approach of continuous improvement. We published, and this primarily involves publishing service delivery standards and monitoring those. Our focus was also on strengthening our ICT environment and then on developing the new structure and business model for the CIPC. This year, the focus is on implementing the approved structure and the applied the word is escaping me, but essentially our new service delivery model, as well as improving other matters such as IVT. So I think you might be familiar with this. We are now in phase four, where we are implementing version. Our focus for the next 3 years, our aspirations, as outlined in our strategic plan, are to improve the ease of doing business in South Africa, but in particularly to make it easier to transact with us as an organization. And here we focus on, we have a strong e-filing strategy, as well as a collaboration strategy. We collaborate with innovative partners, such as FNB, as well as SARS. Our focus is also on compliance, proactive compliance, then on further collaboration to specifically in the intellectual property area, and then lastly on implementing our new service delivery model. In terms of the highlights, both in terms of our annual report as well as the last two quarters, in the previous financial year, we had a strong focus on not just providing more online services, but also to migrate customers to those online services. So one of the big achievements was, of course, the online company registration. Then we also initiated collaborative efforts, both with FED as well as the SARS, to make it easier for businesses to transact. We developed an online e-filing module for all the intellectual property areas, or that process began last year and was concluded this year. We also focused very much on data cleansing last year, and that is, of course, an ongoing effort for us as an organization. This year, I think we've been talking about the FNB project for just about every presentation that I've made to Parliament, but I'm very proud to announce that we started piloting or testing it fully in June, and the full rollout, the full launch was in August this year. We also, during the month of August, redeveloped our annual return system. We made a decision to bring down the system at the end of July and to redevelop it. And we relaunched it in August, so we brought it down for the month of July. This year we're also opening a new office in Sunnyside, so we're separating our office from the front office part, and that is hopefully going to be launched in November. What we're introducing there are self-service terminals, something I'm very excited about, because they're big terminals and it's like a big iPad, which is very easy to use. And we're also working closely with the Department of Home Affairs to integrate fingerprint ID verification. and something we can talk about as well. And then in July, we also received the approval to implement our new structure from the Treasury, and we have implemented it. It became fully operational on the 1st of September, and we have, I think in the past month, during the month of September, also finalized the appointment of people that we had on contract in the organization. So our challenges as an organization, there have been lots of achievements, but they are always challenges. Our challenges remain our accessibility, and I'll report a little bit more on that. We have a concerted focus on quality integrity of our databases. It's a key issue as a registry. This is very important, and even though a lot of work was done in the previous financial year, it's an ongoing issue for us. We also continue to focus on resources. We have a slightly bigger structure now, but because we've not been recruiting people for 3 years, we have lost some staff. And then IT stability, so that is a continuing issue for us. We've made some quite, I think, substantial gains in it, but there's still a lot more that needs to be done. Okay, just to remind everybody, we had three goals. The first, to improve the competitiveness of the South African business environment, to promote and support innovation, creativity, and indigenous cultural expression, and then to promote broader economic, formal economic participation. In terms of our first goal, this largely deals, for example, with registration issues as well as enforcement. In terms of company registrations, you will have noted that, in fact, I think this is a better slide to quickly talk through this. Company registration has clearly dramatically increased after 2011, when the closed corporations, when we eventually stopped registering closed corporations. In the previous financial year, we were back at registration levels that are closely comparable to what we've seen in the past, and I think it's closely linked with economic activity. In the first 2 quarters of this year, we've registered 122,000 companies, so we think that for the year, we think that a realistic level, given the current economic environment, in terms of company registration, is probably around 220,000-240,000 companies, and that is what we will achieve again this year. We've seen a substantial growth in cooperative registration over the past 2 years, I think because of the government, the push on the government policy around this. So last year we registered 21,000 cooperatives, and we think this year it will be roughly around the same level. So what's happened, as you can see, is between 2011 and 2012, there was an increase in the volume of work that we dealt with as an organization. And what we achieved during that period was also an improvement in service levels. I think I'm going in the wrong direction here. I just quickly wanted to touch on the turnaround time. So last year we implemented the service delivery standards, and we explored different ways of measuring them. We did some independent auditing, third-party auditing of the standards, but we found that the sample size were too small. So this year Nokonda has introduced a new way of measuring it, and we have much more accurate data. It's also quite pleasing to see in terms of company registration, 92% of the manual transactions were processed within the 25 working days, which is what our service standard is. The average turnaround time for manual transactions is about 16 days. 99% of the online company registrations were processed within the 3 working days. The average turnaround time is 1.5 days. So in the previous financial year, we set our targets fairly conservatively. We wanted to ensure that we could achieve them and improve on them. I think something that's had a big impact on our ability to improve service delivery has been the ICT stabilization. So just to show again, this year we have again seen more electronic registrations, which is definitely the focus for us. In those areas where we provide electronic registration, we're encouraging specifically intermediaries to do that. And one of the other big changes that we introduced this year, last year already, was that we allow people to fax and email documents to us to make our services accessible around the country, and we've seen a big uptake on that. In terms of cooperative registration, I mentioned earlier that we've had a big increase in the number, over time, in the number of volumes. We didn't have a big increase in the staff complement dealing with it, and so I think that has been a big problem in the area of cooperative registration. It's a purely manual process at this stage, and so the staff numbers, it remained the same, but the volumes had increased. So we only achieved in the last quarter 78% of the registrations within the service delivery standard. But with the implementation of a new structure, what we've done is we've moved a lot of people from the front office into the back office, so we are quite confident that we will be able to bring the turnaround time down. I think another big issue is to make this available electronically, but we do have to wait for the regulations to be concluded before we will do that. Otherwise, there may be wasteful expenditure. An important role that the CIPC, that's what differentiates us from Cipro in particular, is the enforcement investigative capacity that we have. And we certainly saw a big increase last year in the number of complaints that we received. We received 583 complaints. Again, we haven't increased the number of staff, and so a lot of those cases are probably taking slightly longer than it should. We've also decided to group matters that are similar in nature and to rather have a bigger sort of investigation and issue compliance notices, so that is also impacting, I think, on the turnaround time. But we have a lot of vacancies. We've created a lot more positions in this area, and we'll be advertising soon. So I think next year when we report on this, we'll be able to give you a much better picture. Business rescue, I think maybe the biggest issue here to highlight is that last year we saw not a huge increase, but we continue to see quite a lot of activity in this area in terms of the number of notices that have been filed with us. So when a company entered into business rescue, they need to file a notice with us, and they also need to appoint a practitioner. So that's why there's quite a close relationship here. What we found is that, in fact, in terms of business rescue, it is mostly private companies, small businesses, that are entering business rescue. In terms of annual returns, I mentioned earlier that we brought down the system in July and then relaunched it early in August. We redeveloped the system within a period of a month. And it's made a huge increase on the improvements. On the first day, on the 5th of August, we registered or received 8,000 annual return lodgements, and on the Tuesday, 10,000. So usually in the past, we received around 1,500 lodgements a day. So the system has obviously made a big difference. The compliance, annual return compliance rate, our target for the year is 50%. It currently is at 39%, but we find that there are a lot of companies in that number that have never filed annual returns and that probably need to be re-registered. So that will be done over and above. We also have a compliance campaign and a compliance program this year around annual returns. In terms of the intellectual property area, and you can see the numbers again have been increasing, and in fact in the trademark area we received last year the largest number of applications that we have over the past 10 years. The relationship between local and international filings in the trademark areas remained fairly focused on the local market. 58% of those of the applications were local. We don't see quite the same kind of proportions in the design and patent area, but overall the percentages are probably aligned with the international trends. So in terms of the latest performance, the last two quarters, we are generally, except for copyright, well, even in the copyright area, the averages are all within the service delivery standards. It is really only in the copyright area that we have not managed to meet the service delivery standards. And that, I think, has just been because of the dependence, because of the low volumes on one person to do the registration. It is at this stage still as a manual process. We have rolled out on the, was it the 1st of September, we rolled out the electronic trademark registration, and it functioned very well. We will be rolling out patents a little bit later in this month, and then in November it will be designs and copyright. So you'll be able to lodge electronically in these areas. We've reported previously on our whole answer rate, and it remains the bane of our existence. We have seen some improvement, as you can see, from a very low base of 22%. In September, we had achieved 40%. We set ourselves a conservative target for the year, which was 50, and we haven't quite reached it yet. So it's something that we monitor very closely in the organization, and I assure the committee we will continue to improve. I just want to briefly talk about two issues. The one is the South African, the collaboration with the South African Revenue Services. This is a matter, again, that we've mentioned before. It is effectively about developing a type of a one-stop shop for businesses. And our agreement with SARS is that they will offer an integrated registration service through their 40 offices. We have a project team working on this. And SARS, the indication from SARS was that by February next year, we'll be able to roll out the integrated annual return and tax filing. And a little bit later, probably around June, the integrated registration. The FNB process has already kick-started, and teams are working very hard on the next set of developments. We've engaged with all the other banks, and I think we are progressing quite well with NetBank. I think with APSA and Standard, they might have taken a different approach, but for now, NetBank is a close follower in this regard. Talk about this. I just want to highlight some issues around our ICT environment. This has been a particularly been a big issue, not just it continued to be a big issue for us, which takes up a lot of focus in the organization. But I think we've actually made some good strides in this area. We've upgraded part of the infrastructure. We've stabilized the network issues. And we're focusing on redeveloping certain key applications. Thank you, Rory. And I think maybe Rory can talk about that a little bit more when you ask questions. I think a lot of progress has been made in this area. In terms of data integrity, we had a data cleansing exercise that we dealt with last year, and it did clean up the database quite substantially. We've also compared our database with the SARS database, and there are some further data cleansing issues that emanate from that, both for SARS but also for us. And then I think another big issue is the deregistration of dormant entities. There's still one further bulk deregistration that we need to do this year, and then we will try and deregister on a monthly basis. As you will have noticed, I hope, from the presentation, that in most areas we saw increase last year in the volume of work for the organization, and we had a decrease in the number of staff dealing with the increased volumes. We still managed to achieve efficiencies and, in fact, I think improved service delivery. So I think we're certainly very proud that our staff work very hard. We still have a long way to go. And we need to recruit more staff I mentioned earlier already what's been achieved in terms of the matching and placing. But as an organization, we've not seen the same labor instability in our organization as others have. We work very closely with organized labor throughout the last 2 years, every step of the way, in terms of the design of the structure, the implementation of it. So I think we've been very fortunate with the representatives that we've had in the organization. I'm going to focus on this. Financially, as an organization, our revenue for last year was slightly down from previous years, and this is what we think is as a result of is the change in the fee structure that was introduced in 2011. So I think in terms of annual returns, the revenue was expected to be slightly lower. And our operating expenditure last year increased slightly over the previous financial year, but we still ended the year with a substantial surplus. For the current financial year, the first 6 months into it, we also seem to be on track for a substantial surplus. This is not what we're aiming to do. We are aiming to spend the money, and I think this year our surplus probably will be substantially lower. It's just that a lot of the expenditure hasn't come through yet. There's quite big IT procurement that will also be in, and we are beginning to recruit, so that will also impact on our employee cost. So I think you will have noted from the Auditor General's report that we have a unqualified audit. There were some findings primarily around procurement, and then there are some findings around the usefulness of our performance information. It's something that we try to address in this financial year. It's just about learning as an organization what to measure and how to measure it. You may recall that we, for this year, we retabled our annual performance plan earlier in the year, and we will be refining that. So I think this year the findings will be different, and Nokwanda has put a lot of emphasis on the measurement of the targets. Just wanted to share with you, which unfortunately is very unclear, we can certainly share this information with you in a different format. In order to get the approval from National Treasury, we needed to give them a forecast, a financial forecast. And essentially what we are projecting over the next 10 years is that we will need to adjust our fees, probably annually, just below inflation. We also proposed a once-off adjustment to the intellectual property fees, one that differentiates between smaller businesses and larger businesses, so that the intellectual property areas can at least carry their costs. Right now we cross-subsidize them from the company's area, and we think that that's not right. So that's the change. And with these changes, as an organization, we will be operationally sustainable over the next 10 years. And in fact, we'll be able to fund most of our modernization expenditure through the operating income. So what we will need to start looking at as an organization is what is the value-added services that we will provide to the public. We need to introduce a lot more free services. And I think with this kind of revenue, we will be able to do that quite easily as an organization. So I think a big issue for us is what is the value that we will be adding in future. We also have big surplus, and the sense we had from Treasury is that they'd like us to retain the surplus and not be wasteful in it. So we are going to be conservative in our modernization expenditure, but make sure that we get value for money and that we achieve the improvements that we think are necessary. So I think with that, I've probably highlighted the main points. And I think maybe we should turn to questions, Chair.
All right. Thanks a lot, Commissioner. and then the members can start fielding their questions. I'll start with my extreme left. I'll go to Honorable McIntosh, followed by Honorable Fanon Merve, Hill Lewis, Honorable James, Honorable Mabasa, in that order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Luton. You're as professional and efficient as ever. I must tell you that for men, the ladies are always so smart. They always change their hairstyles and hair colours and things. And sometimes one has to do a double take. But all we can do is grow beards. But anyway, it's really a very nice presentation. And thank you very much, Ms. Luton. I've just got one or two quick questions. The one, and you dealt with it, so I don't want to beat it, the call centres and the Swedish system, but, you know, the Department of DTI lays great emphasis on new business, and one of them is call centres. I mean, there's money available, etc., to establish them, and, I mean, I think those of us who have, you know, have to collect MTN or multi-choice or various other things, there's a very good system of call centres. So I'm a little puzzled that we are still having 60% of calls which are just not answered, probably in frustration. Just another quick comment is that I think it's very exciting there are 250,000 new businesses being registered. I know some of them are CCs, which are doing it. But it's actually telling you that South Africans are busy enterprising. I mean, if we're raising 250,000 new companies or CCs, and that's not even including the co-ops, it shows that we're a country that's doing its best to get ahead. I had a few questions, and I suppose allied to that one, since I can do it, is trusts. Now, there's no mention of trusts. I don't want to make it a major issue, but I think one realizes how many people are using trusts in all kinds of ways. And I can see we've got SARS present with us here in a bishop's colored shirt. I don't know if there's anything prolatic about having them here as holy men. But anyway, it seems to me that if one's looking about neatness, there should be some system, and I don't know that it's actually your responsibility, it's actually, I think, probably Treasury's responsibility, but I still think we mustn't lose sight of trusts. I mean, I think they've been highlighted thanks to Julius Malema. The other question is that business rescue, that's very interesting. Who are the sort of people who have these private companies? Is it the auditors who have them? Is it like people who specialize in insolvencies or something? Who are these business rescue people, and what sort of qualifications do they generally have? If you even know that. Then what interests me is why do designs grow at 27% but papers are so small? Perhaps you can explain to me what a design is. I don't know, is it some clever baby chair? Is it design as opposed to a patent? Well, F&B and SARS, I think you've mentioned, I think that's a great... And then the vacancies, I mean, you've actually got 25% vacancies, 23%. Now, either it's once again these unions who are causing trouble all over the Republic of South Africa, or... It is, if you have that sort of level of vacancies, either you're paying too little or you've got a very unhappy bunch of people working there. I think you should share with the committee why there's such a high vacancy level and what's increased from 17 to 23rd. Then, I understand now what that 10-year projection is. That's a discipline from the Treasury and a good discipline. But it is a forecast, and clearly one hopes you reach there. But I don't think you must lose the sustainability in your surpluses. And then on page 17, there's one little question under current liabilities at the bottom. You've got provisions. And you've increased those provisions from 15 million the previous year to 20 million. Now, I suspect that is for your new building or new premises. Perhaps you could explain that to us and just share with us what's happening about getting a new building or new premises.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair. I would like to just follow up on my colleague here about the call center story. I think we have to see a little bit more energy in that. I mean, you correctly pointed out that this has been a bugbear, but 40% of answered calls is going to affect all your other targets because you are going to be more easy to reach your targets and expand on those targets and do better if you're getting all the calls and answering them. And I think that we really need to see some energy in this regard and maybe some ideas from the team about how this thing can be once and for all improved. And 50% is a modest target. And so I would imagine that should be the absolute minimum that we are looking at and that we should be going really for more aggressive fixing of that thing. The other thing that interests me is that if one ignores, I'm looking at the slide that's on our page 6 at the top about company close corporation cooperative registration statistics. When you stopped registering close corporations, the numbers actually went down very dramatically. You can say that under the column 12, 13, the company registrations are higher. But what about all those other organizations that were closed corporations? I'm ignoring 2008, 2009, because that was crisis year globally for the finances. But if you look at 2019, that's 253,000, so that's 50,000 or something, isn't it? Something like that. Fewer, including only this time, obviously, the companies. But what is happening to all those organizations that were registering as closed corporations? And that leads me to the next point, which is, can we have a breakdown? And perhaps it is in your annual report, and I haven't looked at it. Who are these companies? How big are they? How many people are they employing? I mean, that's a bottom-line question that we always ask everybody who comes before us. What are the job creation potential of your statistics? So if we could have an understanding about who these companies are that have been the 222,000 in the last financial year, I think that would be useful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just wanted to say a thing or two about communication. The previous presenter, firstly, thank you for your presentation. The previous presenter was SABS, and they made a comment about how they didn't see fit to respond to what was being said about them in the media. And I actually regret not saying something in that presentation, but it's more relevant actually to the CIPC. The communication around disruptions in service, around the staff troubles that you're having, the vacancy rates, all of that, it needs to be put out there in a more efficient and effective way, because a great deal of the concerns and complaints that we receive as members of Parliament about your performance relates to people not knowing what's going on at the CIPC, and they can't get access to any information. And as we've heard, the phones are not answered. They can't get the information from the CIPC directly. There's a wonderful model on the JSC about, they have a new service called the SENS, the Stock Exchange New Service SENS, which gives investors, global investors and domestic investors and government and everyone forewarning of bad news. That's the whole job of SENS. It gives people forewarning of bad news. Now, so far as I can tell, when there was a significant disruption in the service, the CIPC service earlier this year, the first that South Africans heard of it was in a press statement you issued the day after the disruption began, even though, according to the press statement, it was a planned disruption because of a system upgrade. Now, that's a perfect example of how you can really up your game on communicating and put a lot of South Africans' minds at ease when they can't get hold of you.
Thank you, Chair. I had two questions related to IP policy, to intellectual property rights policy.
And the first question has to do with capacity at the CIPC. If the recommendations in the new IP policy that cabinet approved is implemented. And just a quote from page 18 of the IP policy, and it reads, Parliament has approved ratification of Madrid Protocol on International Registration of Marks and the Hague System on the International Deposit of Designs. Then goes on to say, however, the instruments of ratification were not deposited with the Director General of WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, due to other policy considerations, for example, the backlogs at IP offices. Now, what that says is that the backlogs are actually affecting IP policy, which is not a good thing at all. And so the question to CIPC, since in the policy document it says that we will establish in South Africa a patent search and examination office for the first time, is whether you have the capacity to actually house it. And so that's my first question. The second question has to do with your role when it comes to the Indigenous Knowledge System. Just to clarify, whether you simply deal with registration and recordings, who deals with the enforcement of rights, who deals with, I mean, how do you assign ownership, and how do you, and where does the royalty payments? How does that machinery work in terms of what's contained in the Intellectual Property Rights Amendment bill that's now going through the system? I'm sorry. Property rights.
Thanks for the chair. Thank you very much for the inputs that you have made and for the strides that you have taken. But my question is a follow-up from the questions that have been asked by my colleagues on the 60% calls abandoned. What happens to the rest of the percentage? What happens to the abandoned? What subsequently happens to those calls? Do the people have to own again? And so that it's a bit of a serious concern. And what strategy do you have of selling CIPC to the different regions and provinces in a reach out manner? I mean, seeing that our development is asymmetric, we have certain areas that are very backward technologically, infrastructure-wise. How do you sell yourselves to such? How do you make it easy for them to use CIPC and to register? And then the last one will relate to these organizations that the rescue part. In those that you are rescuing, do you also rescue cooperatives? Or it's only the other part of businesses? Thanks, Correcte.
Honorable members, those were the only hands which were up. Is there any other member who wants to raise any questions before I hand over to the commissioner? One, two, three, gone. All right. Chairperson or commissioner. On the issue of the vacancy rate, it's a problem. It's not good. With the high rate of unemployment, and then what is worse is the issue of the surplus, which is being posted, is that really we cannot put the resources at the back burner when the people are challenged outside. And then apart from that, is that even the institution itself has to be strong, whereupon
So are you going to be aggressive in moving forward in ensuring that at least the vacancy rate must go below 5%? And then the other issue is the issue of the Swedish model of the call center. I'm really interested in that because, you know, the Swedes have produced a lot of things, Nobel Peace Prize awards, Volvo, they've come with a lot of things. And then West Park did the best part, you know, they produced Olaf Palmer and the prime minister. That was the best product they ever produced there. So what does this Swedish call system involve? What is it take? Can you go to town around that issue? And then the last one, but not the least, is the issue of the campus. You know, we were embarrassed after the Kenyan issue, where the so-called white widow went through South Africa. Our system is in such a way that those guys cannot form companies here in South Africa and then try to channel all the funds in an illegal way. Are your system interact enough to detect that and prevent it in particular? Thank you. Can start on that.
Thank you, Chair, and Honourable Committee Members, I'm going to ask my colleagues to start and perhaps Rory's answering questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Honourable Members, for those questions. I'll touch on some of the technical ones that we'll ask. I'll leave call sends the Swedish ones to the Commissioner. That's a competent fee. Just to start with, Honourable Member, regarding the issue of trust, yes. The issue of trusts are not administered by the CIPC. It is a function of the Master of the High Courts. But what we've done is, in our collaboration with SAS, and the Commissioner has mentioned it, the issue of trust and business trust has been raised as part of the data that they receive, and some of the issues that we should pay attention to as far as how they are administered, because it forms the backbone of some of the economic activity. So in terms of our collaboration with SAS, we will be taking it forward and also in having inclusive models with the Master of the High Courts. We have stated that we want to enter into collaborative agreements with entities that add value as far as our mandate is concerned in order to improve on that. So some of the phases that we go through is we'll start with SAS and we'll look at other entities that have an impact, including the issue of trust. Regarding business rescue and business rescue practitioners, of the 142 or so practitioners that have been vetted, I should start with that. You say that CIPC goes through a thorough vetting process. We have a checklist of a certain criteria that have to be met as far as the placing of those practitioners in certain categories of junior, intermediate, and senior. We look at the competency. We look at how many years of experience. We look at qualifications. We look at letters of recommendations. And therefore, we therefore based on those criteria. We've seen the majority of practitioners coming from the legal and accounting profession. I think the accounting profession by far more. But we've also seen insolvency practitioners also coming through as far as those being registered or licensed, as we call it. It is certainly a worry to us because just recently, in terms of the Specialist Commission in Company Law, we had a whole discussion as to how the CIPC will play a more active role to ensure that the integrity of the system is increased and improved, and we will be embarking on a research project which we've just helped to outline in some of the terms of reference in order for us to play a more active role in this area. We want to see it is one of the areas of the new companies that seem to be shining light. Our minister always speaks about it quite proudly, and therefore we're going to play a more active role in that. But it's lawyers, accountants, and insolvency practitioners who are mostly vetted in that area. Regarding the issue of designs and uptaking designs, and another member asked what exactly is the difference between design and patents. Designs, you get two different types of designs. You get something called an aesthetic design, which is the way that something looks, and you get something called a functional design, which is something that has the shape is useful in the functionality of that particular thing. We have seen, but there is a very close alignment between functional designs and patents, because they have some sort of an innovative structure to it, and a new structure to it, in terms of that. But designs have certainly seen an increase, and we need to do analysis as to some of why the increase is not done in those areas. Regarding the issue of vacancies, can I ask that question? The issue of vacancies was I think the Commissioner in her in a presentation stated that we were not, based on the agreement with organized labor, when CIPC became the Commission, we had an agreement with organized labor that we built an organization design process. Thereafter, we would do the matching and placing process, and therefore we will look at the advertising and filling of those vacancies, which means that we have not been able to recruit based on that agreement. But now that we've just completed our matching and placing and our permanent staff are all in the areas, some of them are placed in new areas, it's quite an exciting journey ahead of us for some of them. We've also looked at the area of contractors and making those contractors which we have permanent members of our institution, which we also just concluded last week. We now can see exactly what the vacancy rate is. In the last 2 to 3 weeks, we prioritized some areas as far as recruiting, mainly in the IT area. And we've advertised and we've interviewed for 3 senior positions in our IT area, and those will be coming on board as far as joining the institution. We will then look at other areas of priority. I think some of the areas is in the financial area, and some of them are in terms of productivity or operational areas. We will be having a meeting tomorrow, for example, where we identify some of those ones for recruitment, and if we will have an active recruitment drive in order to capitalize the institution going forward. We do understand this challenge, but now that we have this agreement with organized labor, which has now ended because our institution has been defined, we can go out and we can actively recruit and we take this quite seriously in order to have our full numbers. When it comes to the issue of, I don't remember if Fandanarva asked the question about CCs. What we've done is, as an institution, a CC is an institution, a form enterprise that was quite easy to start and quite easy to manage, but many of the tenets of close corporation law then brought only into new company or smaller company law. But what we've done is an institution, we took a defined decision that we need to encourage quality of registration more than quantity of registration. Because what we see year on year is there was a mass increase in CC registration, but also a mass increase in deregistration of closed corporations. So we see us play a more active role in educating, of hand-holding for people to make the right decisions when it comes to the type of entity that they want to incorporate, and therefore quality of registration, the value proposition that company law gives to them is something that we take quite seriously. As far as education, as far as us not chasing the numbers as well. We do see the activity quite high, something in the region of 240,000 new companies annually. It's quite a high figure. We have one of the highest figures in the size of company, the size of country that we have in the developing world, and therefore we like to see that it's a measure of our education size as well as a measure of us wanting to improve on the quality of those forms of registration. The majority of type of registration that we see, and this goes into your next question, is that we see a smaller type of private company by far, 75, maybe 80% of this is a 2-3 man, single person type of registration. And we also need to look at some of the analysis around when the annual returns are large, we need to look at size and capacity of deployment, and those are some of the initiatives that we're going to be building into our annual return system. I think the Commission did mention that when we redefined the annual return system, it was the first phase. We're looking at the second phase of getting more quality of data, and therefore we can see exactly what type of activity around those areas are. But by far and large, it's definitely the smaller type of private company that is being incorporated. To touch on also the issue of business rescue, the question was asked, does it apply to co-ops? No, it does not apply to co-ops. We need to actually, when the amendment was done, I think we need to actually look at that because it's just currently in place within company law, certainly. But there's no applicability to cooperatives in that area.
Let me just quickly come in on the ones that remain. I think on the call center, the difficulty with the call center, we've gone through all sorts of different scenarios. We can't just... any call center that deals with our work, because of our legacy systems, actually needs to be located with us. So we can't have a call center that's off the campus because they won't be able to access our systems, and therefore they won't really, all they'll be able to do is answer the call. They won't be able to give the client any assistance. So we've had to look at ways in which we can essentially increase the way our own organization answering the call. And so I think that is the discipline that we are instilling in the organization. And we've just recently had a conversation about that, and Rory's going to be spearheading an initiative in that regard to really, I think as the Honourable Solomon has said, increase the energy in this area. It is a big issue for us as an organisation, probably one of the biggest at this stage. That Swedish model is in this area, what they've done in Sweden in a Swedish company office is they essentially have implemented a switchboard system that, well, let me step back a little bit. What happens there is that they did away with their call center because they found that the call answer rates just weren't improving. And so they abandoned the idea of a call center, and they said that what they're going to be doing is actually having people in the organization that are knowledgeable about the work of the organization answering the calls. And so they schedule people for 1 to 2 hours a day to answer calls as internal staff. And what that does, it allows people, I think part of the problem with the call center environment is very hard to keep your staff motivated because call center work is hard. Is that when they open those phone lines, the calls just come, and you deal with it, and it's unrelenting. So it is a very good idea, actually, to create some diversity. So we are, this month, actually trying to fully roll this out. We've got 90 people in the organization now that are connected to these soft phone licenses, and we're hoping that it's going to make a difference. I think in the end, what it's going to come down to is people taking responsibility for the calls that are coming through them. And that's a culture change that we need to implement in some areas of the organization. So we're looking at a whole range of measures in that regard to enforce that culture change, to encourage and enforce it. The first step is to actually measure the number of the calls and what the calls that individuals are answering. So by improving our accountability in this area, and it is forms part of the job descriptions now, so it will form part of the measurement of those job descriptions. People will have norms associated with it. But I don't think it's going to be, in Sweden it took them 2 years to perfect the model. Now they answer the phone in less than 60 seconds. So that's what, and they have the same call volumes that we have. So we're hoping that we can learn from them and replicate that. I think we can't agree more with the issue of communication. We do try and communicate with our customers, with those people that transact with us regularly. We send out customer notices. So when earlier in the year, when we had planned system upgrades, we sent out a notice 2 weeks before the upgrade was being implemented. It's unfortunate to warn people that we were upgrading, so we do actually notify people in advance of upgrades. The problem is when we switch everything back on and it's not seamless, then we need to communicate, and I think that's what happened then. But I think we absolutely agree. One can never communicate. It's certainly an area of focus, and one can never communicate enough. In terms of the IT policy recommendations, our own comment to DTI is that what it states in the policy is not entirely correct. There haven't been any backlogs for the last 3 years in the intellectual property area. So we've been engaging with DTI on this. We feel quite passionately that we should be acceding fully to Madrid, that the instrument should be deposited, as well as with Hague. We do have the capacity to deal with it. Now, with the online filing, we're going to see a lot of efficiencies in our office, and we will have increased capacity to deal with these things. And we think that there will be a lot of benefits to South African businesses, in particular, to bring down the cost of filing, so internationally, not just in South Africa. So, and this is a comment we have made and are making to DGI ourselves. In terms of the patent, the substantive search and examination, we have made provision right now for 20 examiners. We don't think that we would have capacity in our country to examine all areas, and we will need to choose. As a country, there's a policy issue. It needs to be aligned with the policy and where we think the biggest capacity potential is. We also think that technology in this area will assist, and we have recently engaged, or we formed a collaboration with the BRICS IP offices, They met in July in South Africa, and we've just met in Geneva again, so everybody's on board. We have a roadmap. One of the outcomes of that was an electronic search engine, what they call the e-examiner, and the Russian office has developed that, and we will be piloting it with them. We think that for the development of substantive search and examination capacity, we need at least 2 years. We need to train the people that we employ, and then we think with the use of technology, we can actually be quite efficient. We think it's also very important because the cost of search and examination needs to be brought down internationally, and we think we can pioneer something here with this. So we're very excited about that. In terms of IKS, I don't know, Rory, if you want to answer that question about our role. I think that answers most questions. Oh, the provision one. Let me just answer the provision one quickly. The provision is an accrual for payments that were made that were in terms of the previous financial year and that hadn't been made. The biggest increase in the accrual was a bonus provision. What we did last year is we paid everybody in the organization, I think except for me, a flat bonus of 14,000 rand. That's what we did for everybody in the organization, though. Nothing. Disclosed in the annual report.
Thank you, Commissioner. There's a couple of ones. The one about, in terms of IKS, is we are responsible for registration and call, education in the area. We're not involved in enforcement of rights. We will look at also the issue of the trust administration. You know, in terms of IKS, there's administration of a trust, and we are responsible for that. But besides that, we don't get involved in any of their rights. In terms of the issue, I'm not sure, Honourable Chair, I would have answered quite confidently to say that we are in some form of collaboration with Home Affairs to try to deal with white women issues. but before the password came about, it might not be such a good answer anymore based on Home Affairs, the issue that arose. But we are rolling out, as the Commissioner said, a new service, which is a self-service terminal. And what will those self-service terminals have? It will have a direct link via a biometric application to Home Affairs. So when we register the company, you also require to put your fingerprints, and it's direct, it's an instantaneous link that we have with Home Affairs. We have been in active engagement with them. It's quite an exciting collaborative effort. The team has been meeting, and therefore our systems will gear towards this type of verification process regarding that. So the mechanisms for verification, mechanisms for identification is there, and we'll utilize those services accordingly. There was another question regarding the CIPC and its education initiatives by the Honourable Member. We currently are very active in the area that both Deputy Ministers have active programs as far as rolling out the DTI services to various communities. And CIPC is one of the strategic partners in those initiatives. So we accompany DM's program, set both DMs. Just last week, the teams were fully involved and active in Northwest, as well as in Mpumalanga. Today, for example, they announced rates with the Small Business Summit, and they have schedules for every single week. So we are part of that. It's co-ops, it's companies, it's IP, it's all the areas and the mandates that we have, as well as other areas that DTI are responsible for. So I can assure you, Andremba, that we are involved, and we have an education wing that's quite geared towards it. And we will capacitize it also fully as far as some of the vacancies that we have in education, and therefore we will expand on that particular matter.
I heard Dr. James, I saw his hand up. Make a follow-up.
So, thank you. Just a follow-up question on having to choose when it comes to what the EC office will do in terms of IP. Now, the biggest issue, as you know, has to do with pharmaceutical drugs. And in order to establish patents, what you need to do is establish what the active chemical compound are in any, you know, organic compound. So the biochemistry is key to understanding and examining the biochemistry, is key to establishing patent rights. So that's where the action is. So I mean, it's fine to say you can choose, but you can't not do that. And the question is, and it's a complicated business, it costs a lot of money, a lot of other countries do it, and have been doing it. So the question is, well, you know, how do you add value, and how do you plan in terms of staffing
in terms of scientists and others to deal with a particular issue.
Well, I can't profess to be an expert in this area, and I think, you know, we are at the beginning of exploring where exactly, what exactly our role should be. My understanding of it is, though, that essentially what we need to do is, this would be one of the sectors, yes, biotech would be one of the sectors. We probably need to look at three sectors, and I think that we shouldn't underestimate the value that technology can play in this. Because I think the big issue is you need to be able to identify novelty. And once you've identified novelty, then have some. And I think technology can actually play a role in that, building on what other organizations have done. So I don't think, for me, a search and examination, substantive search and examination, is not a short. It's not going to be something that we're going to achieve in the short run. It's a 2 to 3 year preparation that we need to do. And I think what we need to be very careful of, not just as an office but as a country, is that we don't become like Brazil or even the US, where you've got 10-year backlogs in these areas. So so we need to be pragmatic, and we need to understand exactly what our role is as an office, and we need to choose. So I think, one, we should be careful not to say that we can deal with everything. We'll have to have partnerships. We can have partnerships with some of the other offices. You know, everybody's coming to offer their services, the EPO. Everybody's offering their services. So I think what we need to do is have a pragmatic approach, because what we don't want is we want this to be of assistance and to reduce the cost of patenting locally, but not introduce something that's actually going to become a dominant problem. So we will need to be pragmatic, and we'll need to know, we'll need to do proper research and preparation for this before we implement it. I don't know if I understood the question fully.
Let me just push it. I mean, I understand you're setting this up. The big issue in IP policy when it comes to pharmaceutical products is when companies make one small change to a medicine or a biomedical therapy that is about to go off patent. Okay, so you have a 20-year long patent on warfarin. Well, it's off patent is a bad example. And what they do is they make just one small biochemical change. And if you want to stop that practice, we want to stop that practice when it comes to genetics, you must have the capacity to establish it or not. And it's not a simple process. So that's what I'm asking. And you have to be ready then with the proper staff, for the proper, you know, systems to be able to do that in a way that meets your strategic objectives in terms of efficiency. Perhaps it's just a point I want to make rather than a question.
Chair, I think we definitely accept the point. And we don't think that this is going to be just, you know, something that we should walk into. We need to be prepared, and we need to know what we're doing.
Honourable members, I think that we have come to an end of this meeting. We really appreciate the input from the Commission itself. I think what is good is the posture of the people who are here. You can see that they are working as a team. I think that if all the various departments and entities can work like that, is then that we can have a solid ground for which to grow. Because it can show that these people, they are able to share their work. They've got confidence, the Commission's got confidence in delegating. Which is sometimes very rare. You know, from the posture of the people, you can see whether the person is really sure what he or she is doing. But today I was very assured that we really are working as a team. I think that we must continue to do that. I know that the challenges cannot be overcome overnight, but I think that with the team, we will be able to take this institution to the higher heights, to the greater heights. I'd also like to thank the DTI, the DTI representatives, from being here throughout the whole process. I think that the DTI is one of the best performing departments precisely because of the vision of its staff members. So your work is highly appreciated. And then, of course, I cannot forget my colleagues who always make, it's very rare, you know, when you go to the other committees, to have the full complement of the members. The people we have here today are all the members of the committee. Those who are not there had apologies. So it shows the commitment which the members of parliament have in their job, in their jobs. You know, I think that as they go out and speak with the people on the ground, they must really appreciate that. So that's why I'm making an offer to all the members who want to return to Parliament next year, I can make a recommendation from my office. And say, I make a recommendation for you to go back. Members, tomorrow's meeting is at 9 o'clock at E249. The venue for tomorrow's meeting has changed. It is E249 at 9 o'clock in the morning. So I think that come back tomorrow in your full force so that we can be able to discuss the issues of the country. Thanks a lot. The meeting stays adjourned.